Hi, everyone, and welcome to an update. I'm Michael Frazis, and today I thought we'd just go through a few companies that have reported and talk about some interesting data that has come out. And as always, please send through any questions on the chat, or I think there's a question function as well, and I will try to answer. So without further ado, I'm going to put the slides on. Okay, so this is us. We actually had a pretty good month, so our returns are higher than this so far. We invest in technology and the life sciences in companies that people really love with explosive growth. We also do a lot of, life sciences work. It's very advanced technology, advanced platform technology. So companies that are building, have IP and have developed technology that allows them to spin out treatment after treatment, as opposed to, you know, a single drug company that carries a huge amount of risk. There's some interesting data that came out that said that inflation in the US was over 6%. And I think that broadly rings true for everybody. I think we're all feeling it. We're all seeing it, whether it's wage increases or just everything from petrol to real estate, to food, to items in the store, to luxury goods. All prices are rising. And this is as high as inflation has been in a very, very long time. I thought this chart was interesting because it shows inflation from 1990, so basically 30 years of inflation. And you can see that this is higher than it's ever been. That's the blue line. But you can also see the interest rates are still at the lower bound. So in the 90s, interest rates in the US were way above inflation. You know, that kind of range between 3 and 6.5%, while inflation was much lower than it was today. Now inflation is much higher. And the Fed funds are locked down at the zero bound still, not close enough. And that is interesting because that is, I guess, an inflationary setup. So typically what happens is, you know, inflation rises, prices rise, wages rise, economies go great. Then slowly they lift rates to kind of try and take the heat out of the economy. And then sooner or later that too much cash comes out of people's wallets and money flows reverse. Often then markets will sell off. They'll often sell off in anticipating that. And then, you know, a few months later, you'll get data that said actually you're in a recession a few months ago. And it started, and that withdrawal of liquidity, everybody just kind of like pulling cash into themselves from people to companies to obviously financial investors as well, causes those recession. Often then when the data comes out, that's about the market bottom. And then markets and equities start to rally and everyone thinks, you know, why on earth are things rally when the news is so bad? It's like a typical dynamic. This is different so far because they're really resisting the urge to raise rates and actually still pumping money into an economy that is, you know, growing that is growing and is very strong with prices themselves rising at over 6%. So that's pretty uncharted territory, I think, in the modern era. This next chart shows that differential. So there's 6% differential between the Fed funds rate and inflation. And that is more than it's ever been in history. There's two times it came close. That was in the 70s and right at the beginning of the 80s. Both of those coincided with very steep recessions and steep sell-offs. So that is not great. You know, it kind of shows that when inflation is really high, interest rates rise and cause those recessions. But it's important to note that it's generally not the inflation itself that causes the problem. It's the reaction to it. Obviously, the reaction to that is for a very valid reason, namely you don't want it to spiral out even further out of control. But it really is interest rates that make the difference. You know, if mortgage rates go from 2% to 4% and they've already started rising, that's a pretty significant hit to most families. That means your monthly interest bill is twice as much. And that cash comes straight out of your wallet, straight out of places where you would buy other things. And obviously you don't get anything extra for that. So that's kind of like, I guess, one of the core mechanisms by which high interest rates cause so much trouble. And again, it's strange. This time, it's just not happening. Like, there's no appetite for central bankers to raise rates. And I guess the most optimistic scenario is that they do over the next year. And because there's higher debt loads now, it takes a smaller rise than usual to achieve the effect they want to achieve. I want to zoom in into the 1970s and actually what happened, because there's a couple of interesting parallels. Actually, the most interesting one is there was an oil spike, which kind of caused a lot of the inflation and caused a reaction to it. And there's something similar going on now where energy prices are rising. This time it's due to different reasons. It's due to systematic institutional underinvestment in new energy assets, not just because of economic reasons, but for ESG. So companies like oil companies, commodities companies are trying to like sell their coal mines, and you know, nobody wants to be invested in energy. Everyone's moving away from it. The effect of that is that prices are going to be higher and are going to be systematically higher. There's no way around that. Now there's alternatives, of course. There's all sorts of green energy, which become far more economic when energy prices are higher. And that is already happening. You know, it was also happening from consumer preferences. So millions of people in Australia, for example, put solar on their roofs. That was a consumer preference. They paid for it themselves. My personal view on these things is that that's kind of the right way for these things to happen. We all want kind of like a green, happy world. And those that want that should pay for that. But it is interesting parallel. So you can see there was a 49% bear market from 1972 to 1974. And that is coincided with like a steep rise in interest rates, I guess from, you know, 2.5%, well above 10%, actually at 14%. Second bear market. Oh, you can also see CPI actually came after that. So in this case, they lifted interest rates before inflation rose. Now inflation's rising before, and we'll just have to see what happens over the coming years. This zooms out over another 20 years. So the white line is the chart. So you can see in the 70s, where they call it a lost decade, but in nominal terms, equities did have a positive return. In the 80s, there was a very strong rally from the early 80s, where there was a recession, extremely high interest rates, above 20%, higher inflation, you know, inflation peaking at 15%. And that caused a low. You know, it's, I've always thought about these two scenarios. As these are the worst possible things that can happen to equities, because they're kind of a two-year bear market. It's very hard to survive that. It's very hard to kind of, certainly as a professional money manager, it's very hard to survive that as a business. And it's very hard for even individual investors to stay invested. But it's important to note that, you know, after that, equity indices rallied hard. You know, they more than tripled off the lows, far more than tripled actually. And if you zoom out to the 1990s, you can see the picture. It was so important to stay invested. And there's a ton of people who made their careers by surviving those horrific two bear markets. And it actually didn't get as bad. The next year, you have to go all the way to 2007 to get a broad index sell-off as bad. I mean, 2000 was also a significant sell-off, but it was basically in tech and growth, whereas value actually went up over that period. So these things are rare. These situations are rare. You know, we haven't had inflation like this and potentially a corresponding rise in interest rates for 30 years plus. Interestingly, I thought the Aussie dollar would be ripping here in this kind of situation, but it's not, because Australia's been kind of weak and there's tightening going on, which means money's flowing into the US. It's also interesting because it has a pretty significant effect on, you know, certain stocks. So there's a whole heap of top tier software and internet businesses that are trading at 100 times sales. This is Cloudflare. Always wanted to buy it. Think it's a great company. Don't have any particular insight as to why it's so amazing, other than we all know it is. Its growth was lower than what we'd usually look for, you know, 50-60%, and the valuation multiples were almost always far higher, and over 100 times. That's pretty serious. If you actually look at the numbers, you know, this is a $62 billion company on $600 million of revenue, and that's not revenue growing 100%. That's revenue growing at, you know, 50%. So you're starting to see in the market a lot of these super high, the top four or five companies are maintaining these multiples. You're starting to see big contractions elsewhere. I think you're going to see a lot more of that. And so I'd be curious to see what happens to Cloudflare as a kind of case study. We don't have a dog in the fight, so it's purely out of curiosity. You could see something like Snowflake, you know, went sideways for quite a while after it got 100 times sales, but Snowflake was growing much faster. If this starts selling off, it will be interesting to see where it kind of bottoms out in terms of a multiple. But, you know, it's a hugely important company for the internet, and extremely robust. This is an example of something that can happens. This is Lightspeed. They basically do payments for small businesses, you know, three shop chains. And you can see that even recently it was trading at 30 times sales. And, you know, within a couple of short weeks, you know, it's dropped all the way back down to 15. So multiples can halve really quickly. You can see that happened in, I guess, a couple of weeks ago, it was trading at 125. Now it's trading at about 66. And that's kind of what the kind of opportunities that you look for. You want something that's growing extremely fast, reporting extremely strongly, expectations way ahead, collapses in price, you move forward in time. It's a bigger, better, more valuable company. Also, the other thing about inflation is like, what is it? Inflation is rising prices. There's a ton of things, companies and sectors that do well. I'm not specifically drawing like Setar, which is luxury fashion, towards inflation, but it is an example of a company where, you know, in prices are rising because things are booming. Everybody's kind of doing pretty well. Well, not everybody, but on average, people are doing very well. Wages are rising, prices are rising. There's a lot of companies, especially in nominal dollars, that will do really well in these environments. And our job is to have as many of these as possible. Setar's up, 7.5 times now. And this is a local Australian opportunity. Camplify has done something like 3 times now. So there's plenty of opportunities now, even in the local market. Upstart is kind of a funny one. Again, you can see there's multiple contraction that's going on. Very strong earnings. This is the one that's famous. There's a guy, Mark Minervi, who was, I was reading books about this guy. It must be like 15 years ago. And he's one of those original kind of stock market gurus. No idea how good or bad he actually is. He's clearly, I feel like if you've been around for 20 or 30 years and you're actually very good at making money in markets, you probably should be a billionaire or something. You should probably should be doing extremely well. Just even hitting 20% a year for 20 or 30 years lands you with pretty serious numbers. But he got caught live on TV talking up this stock, and then not no, then the presenter was asked, "So what do they do exactly?" And he just had no idea and pretended that he couldn't hear, and then cut out. And that was kind of right at the top of this chart. So it's gone from $50 all the way to 350, and a stunning rise from 125, 130 up. We actually own this stock, by the way, full disclosure. So we bought over the last earnings results around 125, 130, I think, and it shot all the way up to 400. Did take a tiny bit off just because get really uneasy with these high multiples. Do I have the multiples somewhere? Yeah, went from kind of 12 times sales to 30 times sales, all the way from 30 back to 20, 32 back to 20. I think it's probably about right here. I don't think it's crazy buying opportunity. Obviously, we're not going to sell because we're up quite a bit, and we actually believe in this company. They recently reported revenue is up 250% year on year. It's well above 100% expectation, and all their other numbers, profit metrics, and so on were approved as well. So what these people do to kind of answer the question that wasn't answered on live television in the US, it's basically in the US people give you a credit score, and there's obviously credit scoring in Australia and other countries as well. It's actually a pretty brilliant invention. It's a pretty brilliant thing. Basically, with one number, you can very quickly assess someone's creditworthiness, and all kinds of things can lift that number, and you can make very rapid decisions based on that. Problem is, and because it's so effective and so broadly used and so good, everybody uses it. But because everybody uses it, that means there's an opportunity. So there's people who are better credits than their score would suggest, and obviously vice versa. But the interesting thing for fintech companies is to find those people with low credit scores who are good credits, because you can lend to them and there's obviously profitable business that can be done because they're not able to get access to that finance elsewhere. And that's kind of where Upstart comes in, and where a lot of the modern AI companies in the space are working. That's the opportunity. Credit scores were an amazing invention. It became There was mass adoption, and then there's all the little inefficiencies that that created, and we've created new opportunities for new banks and new lending platforms. If you're a business owner, it's very hard to get lending, for example. It's much easier as an employee. So but a lot of business people are actually pretty good credits. We have huge amounts of expenses that we meet every month, and so there's a huge opportunity to lend to people that kind of slip through the cracks. In Australia, Judo Bank's been very effective at that. So a few years ago, the tightening lending standards made it really hard for business owners to borrow. And that created an opportunity for banks like Judo that could come in and properly assess people and then lend at maybe a little bit more expensive than banks, but still very reasonable rates, and capture that market opportunity. It's also one thing that, I think there's a lot of political movements to kind of really crush down on banking. Often that has the worst possible effect, the opposite effect as intended. And it's crazy to see the smart people who get this wrong all the time. So if you tighten lending standards, you think you're cracking down on the banks, but really what you're doing is saying only the most creditworthy people are going to get access to finance. Other people cannot, and they'll either have to go somewhere that's more predatory, higher interest rate, or they just won't be able to buy their home, or they won't be able to do whatever it is they need to do. And so there's an important balance, and I think Australia probably swung way too far in terms of tightness. Making people Assessing people's credit cards, making people have to change their spending patterns for months before they could do it. And then it's creating all this kind of burden. There's startups now that will use other methods to give you an instant loan, and they can do that whole thing in hours, that whole process in hours. Whereas in banks, as if anyone's tried, it can take many weeks. and some serious massaging of numbers. And I don't think that's particularly productive for anyone, but it does create a huge amount of opportunity for companies like Upstart and other startups. This is not quite a startup at the moment, but you know, we are looking at other opportunities. And you can see, you know, they're 88 mil rev, 160 mil, 220, $750 billion of rev. That's the value creation. These are the kind of journeys you want to be on where a company's doing less than 100 mil to, you know, over $1 billion in, you know, 4 or 5 short years. Typically, you'll get multiple expansion over a company that can execute like that as well. And that's where you get those spectacular returns. So we talked about Opendoor, wrote about Opendoor, talked about it, obviously touches a nerve because it's very widely owned. Zillow was a very widely owned company in Australia. They've wound down their buying, so basically exited the business. Opendoor was up 91% over the quarter. So they increased their revenues by 91% over a period where their competitor lost so much money that they exited the business entirely. So this is kind of like the proof of what we were arguing of our original thesis, was that Opendoor was the right option. Opendoor was a high quality company and that'd go all the way. Didn't have any interest in Zillow, much weaker competitor. Wasn't expecting them to leave until they did. But yeah, you can see that's pretty spectacular. Huge amount of growth. You know, there's enormous opportunity here. This company is trading at, let me see if I can dig it up. I think I put it in here. When we bought it, the company was trading at 1x sales and they're kind of like high single digit, maybe 10% gross margins. So with time, they could actually, I think they could actually maintain a 1x sales, EV sales. It's just 10 times gross profit basically, which is less than what most kind of tech companies would trade for, much less. And it's actually sustainable long-term if you think about what it takes to get 25 times EBITDA. So if the multiple stays the same and they're growing at 91% every quarter, this is a serious return opportunity, like a very serious return opportunity. And it's about a 5.5% position in the fund. I thought these were some interesting comments. So home purchase were up by 79%. You know, they think they can move to about, well, Opendoor's plan and what their kind of eventual intention to do is to try and sell their homes for no fee. So they charge a 5% fee and they vary that according to, you know, the market and market conditions. Their long-term goal is to make that 5% fee they charge zero to outcompete basically everyone, any agent or any other iBuyer, and then make all their revenue in ancillary services. And that's kind of what you want to see. That's kind of like the aggression that you need to really succeed in business. You know, it's kind of the thing that like Amazon would do. You know, your margin is our opportunity. You know, really try and, if that's your long-term goal, it completely changes the kind of pace and feel of an organization. And that's, we think it's a really exciting company. Roblox also reported. So there was news about Facebook and the metaverse. I was pretty skeptical about the whole thing. You know, it's corporate Facebook, it's pretty gross. You know, Facebook platform itself is pretty gross. Roblox is the real deal. It's fun. It's whimsical. This is kind of what the metaverse should be like. A lot of people learn how to code on Roblox as well. And they had really tough comps. So this is September 2021, the quarter, the 3 months to, you know, the end of September 2021. So this time last year, the coronavirus economy was in full swing. And this was the quarter that the comps were really tough. And there's some companies like Peloton, Zoom that have performed very poorly. There's other companies that have managed to continue to grow on top of extremely tough comps. And Roblox is one of them. And, you know, this was trading real cheap. You know, we're buying in the 70s, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, and then it shot up to 100 and then a little bit lower. But you're still, you know, compare Cloudflare trading at 120 times sales to something like this trading at, you know, recently, like literally a week ago, was trading at 13 times sales. That's kind of where we think the opportunities are, and super excited about owning this company long-term. And if you really want a metaverse company, I think this is the kind of thing you should be looking closely at. Carta Libre also reported. Again, another company that pretty strong growth. So September 2020, tough comps. That is 73% year on year. Exactly what we hoped they would do. And you can see the multiple is actually back to its kind of long-term averages. So in the past, when it's done this, and this only shows one, oh, this is the wrong company. In the past, you know, Mercado Libre is up 3 times over the last year since we bought it, and actually more, just shy of 4 times. And, you know, over longer periods of time, it's done even better. So this is kind of like high to mid, the top end of the middle of the range for a company like this that's growing 73% on extremely tough comps, in a region where e-commerce is underpenetrated and payments are extremely underpenetrated. And so we've talked about it a few times, but the opportunity is as live as ever after the last results. So Galaxy Digital, this was probably our number one pick in the crypto space, which is nice. It basically doubled over the last couple of weeks, which helped our performance this month. Still trading, you know, when we bought it, it made $1 billion for 2021, including obviously the forecast for next quarter, and was trading at about seven to eight billion. And now it's a $13 billion company, but it's still exceptionally cheap. And analysts are predicting steep declines over the next year. Now, I think there's a very good chance of the next year revenues actually go up. And if that happens, there's going to be extreme re-rating of this company. And they've really got a chance as a $13 billion company to be the go-to platform for M&A, for prime services, for prime broking, venture capital, and for asset management. You know, all those traditional investment banking functions in the crypto space need specialists. Margins are extremely high. It's not nearly as competitive as conventional investment banking. And it could have a long way to go still. You know, this thing is bouncing around pretty hard as well. So eyes wide open. I also thought I'd share these because I shared Axie Infinity, the game built on Ethereum, that you could stake your Axie, the token, for 126% non-compounded. This is two coins where you can currently stake. So Olympus, the idea is just to create a stable coin without actually linking it to anything. Their current APY is 8,248. Klima, which is this bottom one, is kind of interesting because the idea is that people buy carbon in treasury. You also buy the token. That stuff is then stored. If you stake it, that carbon is locked away. The profits of those are then distributed back to the token, back to the Klima token. And that is currently yielding 36,434. Again, full disclosure, I own a little bit of both of these. And that's a pretty serious amount. It's 9 million tons of CO2. So when you think about the impact that cryptocurrencies can have, Klima at least is one interesting example of how you can take that speculative interest, that ability to code all kinds of economics to build any kind of reserve bank treasury function you want, and actually come up with something really interesting. Upstart, correct. Yeah, Upstart basically is like the AI platform for other banks. They have banking partners. And they're pretty concentrated in their banking partners as well, which is both opportunity and risk. Things like Upstart, look, I think they're pretty robust. That approach, you gotta remember when economies contract, and we just went through a big one, there was a GFC, they're pretty nasty, but you know, smaller loans are generally repaid. And I think it was most credit products still made money in the GFC. Not all of them, obviously. But, you know, personal finance was generally repaid. I just remember seeing a chart of personal finance, and I think they're making about 9% a year. So these are like small personal loans. And even in the GFC, like a really long kind of 2-year extended credit crunch, they still made money every year. So they had losses. They always have losses. But that was covered by the 8-9% or whatever it was. It might have been 12 that they were earning off the book. So I can imagine that changing economic environment makes the stock really volatile, but not in kind of a fatal way for these credit businesses. Oh, thoughts on PayPal? I haven't actually don't have any strong views on PayPal. I don't think it's a particularly exciting company. I think it's a shame that Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and those guys aren't involved. That should have been the bank of the internet. There should be a little PayPal icon in every browser. And you know, they should have been like natively integrating crypto almost immediately. Think of how forward looking those guys were on cryptocurrency. They saw the opportunity pretty early. I don't think the internet's going that way. I don't think internet payments are going PayPal's direction. You know, they're going in the crypto direction where you basically have your own little wallet sitting in the browser that has access to your identity, to your people can message you securely through it. You can pay certain things, all your wallets, all your digital assets are in it. I think that's the future, not PayPal. DermTech last quarterly, we've actually exited this. The reason we exited it is it was paying up a lot for future and we needed some cash to buy some other things, including, you know, some of our more recent purchases that have done quite well. I think they've just got a long way to go, you know, just 2 years away from being a larger, more relevant company. So it was also part of that. another issue that we got caught up in to some extent was part of that huge rush at the beginning of the year into certain growth stocks. Dermtech was caught up in that, and there's a lot of hot money and a lot of expectations built into the price. It's going to take time for that to work its way through. It's still real. It's still like a genuine opportunity, but you know, they're not, the numbers off the top of my head, I think maybe 25 mil revenue over the next year or so on what was recently a $1 billion company. So you really are paying up, and it's going to be a long time before they actually get those cash flow. Now, my personal view is it'll be worth, you know, a few times what it is now over 5 years. So I think that's the play. But there's a good chance also that it's extremely volatile and we'll get a chance to re-enter. But it's not super easy. Hey, Marqeta is very good. So that's on our watch list now. We're very interested in that. Trading off between, as always, between multiple. It has sold off a bit. Again, good results. Extremely strong fundamental performance. It's actually a bunch of companies use it. And even companies like Square use Marqeta, which is surprising. Quantum Sci, last time I looked, it was somewhat unproven technology, and it is part of that hype. There's a part of the market that's basically that SPAC market, and a few things that ripped really hard around the same time. They're still under a ton of pressure, largely. It's only now that some of those are recovering, and some of those are just busted companies that promised the world and, you know, went to $40, $50, now trading at single digits. It's going to take a long time for those to recover. They really need to stand on their own two feet, firstly, financially, because nobody's falling over themselves to finance them, and secondly, to recover. Have you owned, interested in owning Trade Desk? Yeah, we owned it. We bought it, basically. That was one of the companies we bought at the low, and we sold around $800, $900, which seemed smart at the time because it dropped, and now it's basically back up there. So it's like many of these things. Often you should have just held them. I will put that in that bucket. We'll probably regret selling. But again, it's very richly valued. So we're moving away from 40, 50 times sales and certainly away from 100 times sales companies. So we've had a lot of companies that have gone on that journey and we're up 5 to 10 times and then hit those crazy valuations. We've largely sold out of those. That has not paid off. You know, this quarter, all those companies that were at 40, 50 times sales have gone to 80, 100, 120 times sales. So at the moment, you know, that hasn't worked, but you know, we can't base investment decisions based on things going 100 times sales. So ask about Fulgent Genetics. They do a ton of testing. So 92% year on year. There's a lot of companies doing this kind of stuff now, which is, you know, blood tests for cancer, genetic testing. It'd be tough to know. This has rising short interest. This was seen as rightly or wrongly, as a COVID beneficiary. I mean, it was most definitely a COVID beneficiary. Who knows where that lands? Like, it looks like now, like over the next year, travel will be in full swing, but there's still going to be all kinds of testing and masks and rules. I think a really long time to unwind these regulations. Could take years. You literally see a world where coronavirus is barely there, but you still have a ton of rules around it just because the politics of it and the fear and just bureaucracies are really hard to maneuver. Like once they move in a direction, to swing them back. I mean, there's so many people with jobs based around these regulations now in every department, at every level of government, that it's not going to be easy to unwind that. So that gives you confidence that the testing boom will last a bit longer. And so far that's been the case, but I don't have a strong opinion on it. There's also green hydrogen. Green hydrogen's cool, great way to store energy. We bought Plug from $4, rode it to kind of 60, 70. We're actually out of it now. Again, this is one of those companies that went to, you know, 100 plus sales. And also it's a hardware company. I mean, long-term that can't trade like a software company, but it is one of the very, very few ways that you can play, or probably the best way to play hydrogen. So I can see it's, you know, it's almost halfway back to where it was when we originally thought it was too, when we originally sold it, it's too expensive. But, you know, you've got a $25 billion company on 500 mil of hardware revenue, paying up for the opportunity. Green hydrogen's interesting. I mean, it does take a lot of infrastructure. So I think Elon Musk is right. I think the cars will be electric. Whether there's almost certainly other use cases though that you can use hydrogen. So Plug focuses on things like forklifts, places where there's a lot of equipment, a lot of vehicles that can be charged in the same spot. They go out and do their things and then come back. It's a very different dynamic to a personal car where you drive around and go to all different petrol stations. If you can just install, you know, the hydrogen fuel cell and basically they replace batteries, conventional lead acid batteries for some of these, you know, forklifts and I don't know what you call them, those things that drive around boxes inside in massive warehouses and things. I can definitely see how that's just both a greener and better solution. Interestingly, actually, those vehicles replace electric vehicles though in those situations. So the impact on the environment is probably dependent on the source of electricity. Still hold and believe in Taiga. We do have a bit of this. We do have a bit of Taiga and Futu. They have been probably our worst performers of late. We are going to hold. Done the work. We've spoken to people. The conclusion we've come to is that no expert is going to be able to give us the answer that we need, which is what is the regulatory environment going to look like for them in a year's time and going forward. We've spoken to a lot of people, and there's a lot of people on different sides that have strong confidence. These are real companies. They've got, one thing I will say is both Futu and Taiga have significant offshore businesses. And so the likelihood that those are impacted is actually quite low. So there is a value flaw to these companies. There is something there, even in the worst case scenario where all their Chinese clients, they had to close accounts of all their Chinese clients. Even that is considered would be a really extreme thing to do. Less extreme would be saying no more new mainland Chinese customers. That's definitely in the realm of possibility. Increasingly priced in now, I'd say, both those companies. I mean, that's been a wild ride for us. I think our entry price is $16 something. Went all the way to like 28 on Jan 30 this year, and then all the way down to, you know, I guess 7 now or something. So it's been a huge swing. When they report, the thing to look for will be, what is their growth overseas? And if you zero out their mainland Chinese business, how are those companies performing? And then we'll then reassess based on the latest results. And that will determine whether we do more or less in those companies. We'll basically zero out the mainland and value on everything else. What's the outlook for India over the next 5 to 10 years? Look, I don't know, but I've always thought that India was far more interesting than China, funnily enough. You know, it's democracy, much bigger, faster growing population, young population. A lot of the moves from China probably come from weakness, you know, huge demographic time bomb. India doesn't have that. But I also think it's a tough market for an outsider to be in. You know, it's not obvious how to play it. It's typically stocks have not done particularly well there. You know, it's one of those emerging markets where huge amount of growth, but also a huge amount of capital raising. It's probably a great place to be young, tech forward, highly educated, local, I imagine. But we haven't seen any particularly exciting opportunities or really had, you know, been looking for them or had significant amount of access either. What platform do you use to buy your crypto? One thing I think people should try just to understand what's going on. So there's a series of brokers that connect the fiat world to the crypto world. So that's obviously, you know, Coinbase in Australia, CoinSpot. There's a ton of them. You can use Binance. Once you've got some amount of value, it can be a tiny amount in the crypto world, then download MetaMask, which sits in your browser, and then go to a few different Web3 sites. And you go to the site that recognizes your browser. And if you do any interaction there, maybe you create a new player for a game, or you want to stake some coin, or you want to buy an NFT or trade an NFT, it'll then ask you to sign. That transaction will then be signed off by that wallet in your browser and confirmed in your browser by your own wallet and identity. And that's kind of cool. When you see that happen, then you understand why Web3 is such a big deal and why it's different to Web2. And why there's potentially a chance to rework every single website, every single major website, so that it's crypto native. And crypto native means that your identity, your assets, everything's just sitting there in the browser in a cryptographically secure way. It's very interesting. So I'd recommend trying that. But as between the different exchanges, don't have a strong opinion, probably can't help. I've actually got accounts with pretty much all the major brokers. I've got a question on Vection Technologies. Let me have a look at that and I will get back to you next time. Okay, thanks for signing in. Really appreciate it. And I hope you all have a fantastic and wonderful weekend.